I'm Wendy Ring. Welcome to Cool Solutions, stories of climate action from the bottom up. It's just me today. My co-host Brian had been recording remotely from an old iPod, and that finally bit the dust. One paradoxical effect COVID's had on me is that I'm attending more public meetings. I've been to more local government meetings on Zoom than I ever did when I had to go in person. And what I've learned from these meetings is that everybody wants things like bike paths and clean electricity. I mean, what kind of Grinch would be against a bike path? The problem, according to our local elected officials, is there's no money. I've always taken that to mean the subject is closed, but that's the business-as-usual, balance-the-budget way of thinking. The climate doesn't care about our budgets, and penny-pinching there has a rising price tag. The average annual cost of climate-related disasters in the U.S. has gone from $20 billion in the 80s to $120 billion today. Before we all panic and start rummaging under our couch cushions for loose change, I thought I'd get an expert opinion on this question of whether there's really no money. Robert Paulin is an economist at the University of Massachusetts and co-author of the book Climate Crisis and the Global Green New Deal. So let's start with the global picture. How much money does the world have to spend to keep global warming under 1.5 degrees?
It's going to sound like a gigantic, gigantic number, but it's not actually that big. It would take about $4.5 trillion per year on average between now and 2050. Now, again, that sounds like a gigantic, gigantic number, but it's important always to scale these. So how much do we have to spend relative to all the spending that's taking place? And the answer is it's about 2.5%. Now, that's still a lot. It's $4.5 trillion per year, but 97.5% of all economic activity can be devoted to other things.
And that's just the percent of money in motion. There's more out there we could mobilize.
Of financial assets in the world economy, all the stocks, bonds, everything in the world, this would only be about 1.5%.
Can you explain how much $4.5 trillion is in terms we non-economists can relate to?
It's roughly the size of all government spending in the United States. It's not like we're flushing this money down the toilet. Even if we had a fossil fuel-based energy system, we would have to keep investing to accommodate depreciation of the existing assets and to expand. So we would be spending a lot of that money anyway, number one. And number two, once we make the investments in energy efficiency and renewable energy, consumers end up saving money. All consumers, not just people who are, you know, green activists. It's going to be cheaper to keep your house warm, lit, to travel, to commute. Energy efficiency, by definition, means it takes less energy consumption to do a given thing, like keep your house warm or to run a computer. It'll be cheaper. And then secondly, renewable energy, solar, wind in particular, are already either at parity or cheaper than coal, natural gas, oil. The cost of generating a kilowatt of electricity from solar energy has fallen spectacularly just in the last 10 years. It's fallen by over 80%, from about 38 cents per kilowatt of electricity, this is the global average, to about 7 cents. And coal is like twice that. So it's not like when we make these $4 trillion of investments, well, we just blew $4 trillion. No, we've built an energy system that will be fundamental to sustaining life on Earth. But in addition to that, it will deliver just cheaper energy.
Taking this down to the country level, how much does the U.S. need to spend, not counting foreign aid, just to cut our own emissions?
For the U.S., again, it's going to sound like a big number. It would be about $600 billion a year for the next 30 years on average. The total infrastructure bill that they're proposing is $2.3 trillion over 8 years. So that comes to a little less than $300 billion per year. How much of that would go for climate? A generous number is $100 billion of the $300 billion.
There's also $15 billion in the proposed annual budget. Ending fossil fuel subsidies could add another $20 billion. We're still $465 billion a year short. Higher taxes imposed this year on the rich or on corporations will go to pay off the infrastructure bill for the next 8 years. So with only 9 years left to cut emissions in half, where will we find the money?
It wouldn't even be hard to borrow that amount, especially right now. The U.S. government could borrow at 1% interest rate, which is the lowest long-term interest rate that the government has been able to borrow in 70 years. So why not? If you're borrowing at a 1% interest rate, $100 billion, you end up paying $1 billion a year in interest. It's like the federal budget, $3.5 trillion. The $1 billion? Come on. It wouldn't even get noticed. That doesn't even take care of, you know, tissue paper. During COVID, in the past year, the Federal Reserve has purchased approximately $3 trillion of bonds from Wall Street firms to give them cash so they don't collapse. That's $3 trillion in 1 year. The Federal Reserve, if they wanted to, let's say states issue green bonds, the federal government, Federal Reserve, buys the bonds, so they get their money, and they start doing projects at the state level. The funding for that is essentially almost unlimited. I had a discussion about this with Janet Yellen at the time she was chair of the Fed. And she agreed with me that it's something they could do legally. She just said, we haven't done it. There's no precedent. And therefore, it's politically fraught, but it's not beyond what they're legally able to do.
While we're waiting for the Federal Reserve to decide that saving the planet is as important as saving Wall Street, states and localities are finding bottom-up ways to pay for climate action.
I've been a bus rider myself since grade school.
That's Clark Gilman, city councilman and mayor pro tem for the city of Olympia, Washington. He represents the city on the board of Intercity Transit, the regional transit agency. In 2017, that board got bad news. They were running out of money.
Funding for transportation have just been dramatically cut at the federal level over and over again. It used to be that the Federal Transit Agency would pay for 90%.
Now that equation was flipped.
The cost of operating the public transit system was outpacing the revenues that we had. So we knew that we were faced with making cuts if we stayed the status quo. And we decided to do a two-year-long public engagement and discerning process.
They called it the IT road trip, and it wasn't the kind of community input where you put sticker dots on wall posters. Ann Freeman Manzanares, Intercity's general manager, says the way to find out what a community wants is to ask open-ended questions.
What do you want us to look like?
I spent days at our farmers market, sitting at a folding table, talking to all comers about transit. We presented to business groups, community clubs.
Ann was out there too.
Every public event and took every opportunity to reach out into the community.
And had a pretty robust community conversation about the social benefit and the environmental benefits of riding together.
After collecting input from thousands of residents, the choice boiled down to three scenarios. Cut service, raise just enough money to maintain the status quo, or raise more money and transform the system into something better. So they went back on the road to learn which scenario the community wanted, because it had to come out of their pockets.
Washington State is one of the most regressive tax structures in the country. We don't have any sort of income tax and have very low corporate taxes. We're sort of a haven for these billionaires. That's why we have the tech companies here. With that structure, it really comes down to, will you, average working person, pay more property taxes and pay more sales taxes to support the services that you think will benefit your community?
To the board's surprise, 82% of people chose the transformational scenario.
More hours of operation each day, improving the frequency of service, service to new areas.
Bus rapid transit, and a change in the way people pay to ride.
We went through this community-wide exercise where if fares didn't exist, what time would we save? What dollars would we save? How much do you spend on armored car service? How much do you spend administering a reduced cost fare system for some individuals in your community that might have need? How much time do you spend maintaining your fare boxes or responding to fare dispute. We considered our revenue at 8 to 10% range, but when we started to deduct all the costs associated with collecting fare, it came into a little less than 2%.
In November 2018, the ballot included a proposition to raise the sales tax by 0.4%. That's 4 cents on a $10 purchase, or around 60 bucks a year for the average household. The proposition passed by almost 2-1.
We were pleasantly surprised that across our service area, including in some of the more rural conservative areas, there was strong support for taxing ourselves to provide this community service.
The changes will roll out over 5 years, but one of the first improvements was a Crosstown Express.
We're calling it Bus Rapid Transit Light. It runs east to west across our service area every 15 minutes with loading platforms on the sidewalk at both the front and rear doors and just a handful of stops across town. It moves quickly all the way across town, just stopping and curtsying at each of those stops for people to get on and off.
In January 2020, the whole system went fare free. What was it like to ride the bus without a fare for the first time?
There was this enthusiasm that just permeated the community and just an ease of getting on board.
Improvements on-time performance by not having somebody counting their nickels out and holding the bus up.
Our ridership went up just off the bat.
20% in the first month and 39% in the next month.
One real delight was seeing new faces and different faces on the buses. The buses have always served those who don't have access to a car. But we saw more and more people who were riding by choice.
People that were having to educate about how to ride public transportation and allow everybody else to get off, get back so you don't get hit, you know, by the ramp deploying.
Even just those early improvements were enticing drivers out of their cars. In the third month, COVID hit town.
We are mourning a lot of things associated with COVID, but being able to see what heights we could have achieved in ridership is one of the biggest things for us.
Going fare-free made it easier to keep drivers and passengers safe.
So we started to use both the front and the back door to get on and off the vehicle. And when COVID hit, a lot of systems closed that front door so they had some protection for their operator. And we were already using rear door boarding, so it wasn't a big deal for us. And we weren't collecting money.
In these challenging times, not having to pay fares may be the difference between being homeless and hungry or housed and fed. One community college, which used to pay fares for its students, now has resources to help in other ways.
They took those dollars and they are targeting them into a program that keeps students housed so they can stay in school, that keeps students fed. When you talk to individuals who at one point in time spent 25% of their income on transportation, those are amazing stories.
The decision we made to be very inviting of the community in shaping the direction of the transit agency really paid off. Choosing to use a very participatory and open system of governance really paved the way for us to ask our own community to dig into their pockets and support imagining a new, expanded, and improved public transit.
Sustainable Connecticut's Community Match Fund is another example of people's willingness to ante up when they have a say on how the money will be spent. Abe Solorio is their community outreach manager.
It's intended to empower residents and the communities that we're working with to decide on and to lead the solutions that they want to see in their communities. Anybody can lead a project. They don't need to be the municipality. It doesn't need to be a formal nonprofit. We can grant to individuals as well and to informal groups. Anyone who has an idea, who knows the community, who wants to do something. We provide 50% of the costs, and then project leaders raise the other 50%. Where it's different from traditional programs, I mean, none of that sounds really innovative, is that other 50% It's not other grants. It's not municipal budget dollars, corporate sponsorships. Rather, we work with everyone to run a public crowdfunding campaign. And the whole idea is that communities are voting with their dollars to decide what they want to see, rather than us picking what we'll support. And the whole program was designed to get rid of all the traditional barriers up front of a grant. There's no applications. There's no application deadlines. All of it is to say, hey, you've got an idea. You've got something you want to do. So come forward and let's see if we can work together on it.
So people just call you up and say, Abe, I got an idea.
My job is very easy in that I get to tell them, yes, we've got cash. This is a great idea. Go ahead and do it. Of course, they then have to go out there and run the crowdfunding campaign, which is work. There's a coach. So she works with every group as they're launching their campaign, both to help them build out the public facing page, but then also to develop a crowdfunding strategy, how you make those asks, how you go back to donors for a second time. So there's a lot of support.
Do most projects reach their goal?
The average is 121% funded. They're shooting over their goal.
Out of 300 plus projects so far, only 11 didn't raise their target amount.
We're not nuts. We don't say, you're $500 short. Sorry, no grant to you. So if they can demonstrate with $1,000 less, here's all the work that we can still do, then we would still provide the grant. But even when we say no to projects, we always try to say no, but let's talk about other things that might work. We try not to do what you might see in a more traditional grant program where someone sends in an application, you look at it, you say, nope, not eligible.
But wouldn't wealthier towns have an unfair advantage?
That's a great question and something that we were really concerned about when we launched the program as well. Do lower income communities or also small communities? There's 50,000 people in your town. That's a lot of folks to tap for contributions. There's 2,000. You've got a much smaller audience. We just haven't seen any correlation between the income and the size of a town and its ability to run a successful campaign. Hartford has the not great distinction of being one of the lower income capital cities in the country, but there have been 25 community match fund projects in Hartford, and they've been really successful. A lot of the work is making sure that we don't just have the usual suspects who come forward and lead projects and get money where they probably could have gotten it from somewhere else.
Here's a few of the projects the match fund helped happen. A small town's first EV charger. Student clean energy promoters.
In Greenwich, they've implemented food scraps recovery at their transfer station. And then in Stamford, the city actually just raised the money to purchase an industrial composter. It reduces the mass of the food scraps by 90% in 24 hours. And then you take it out, put it in a static pile. 21 days later, it's usable soil amendments. This was also a super successful crowdfunding campaign with tons of engagement from the community. We're looking at it like a pilot that may be able to expand to other cities and towns.
An energy concierge service run by a community housing group.
It's basically like a tailored handholding program. They work with homeowners, with tenants, landlords to help them get the audit, understand what the audit means. And then once they've sort of seen the options that they have for increasing energy efficiency or putting on renewables, work with them to navigate that financing and to actually implement the solutions. Neighborhood Housing Services is a trusted partner. So folks know that they're not having an energy consultant come in who's working with the companies that do the installation, but rather they're working with a partner in community. They anticipated this taking about 5 years. They're now at what they call like year three of their plan, even though it's only the first year. And the group is already talking with people in other cities about bringing the model to there.
Other projects include a summit on multimodal transportation, saving 86 acres of forest, and an apprenticeship program for new farmers. Between crowdfunding and grants, Sustainable CT's Community Match Fund has put $1.7 million into building more sustainable communities. Part of those match funds came from the Connecticut Green Bank. The Connecticut Green Bank is not the kind of bank where you get a checking account. The Green Bank holds public money from a regional carbon cap and trade program and from a ratepayer surcharge on electric bills. And it uses those $30 million a year of public money to prime the pump for private investment in energy efficiency and clean energy, while directing that flow of dollars to the people and places which need it the most.
The conventional government model is to give the money away. Money comes in from taxpayers, it goes out as a grant.
That's Brian Garcia, Connecticut Green Bank's CEO.
What we do is we partner with financial institutions so that they can loan money themselves. For every $1 of our resources, that is from the public sector side, we see $6 to $7 on average of private investment. That is to say that $7 of private money is being mobilized with $1 of green bank money.
The green bank does a couple of things. One is using their money to decrease the risk for private lenders.
We tell community banks and credit unions, you take the first 1.5% of losses of the loans that you underwrite for clean energy improvements for families, and we will take the next 7.5% of losses. People pay their energy loans. So it's typical for losses to be less than 1%. So we're teaching local community banks and credit unions how to fish in the case of providing our families with the necessary capital to finance solar PV on their rooftops, insulation within their walls, more efficient heating and cooling. So we are helping those families by connecting them to local financial institutions through essentially a loan guarantee program. We have helped those local community banks and credit unions finance over $80 million worth of loans, and the Green Bank has only had to pay $75,000 in loan losses. So when you think about that, we have put a little bit of public money out there, and they've put out $80 million.
The Green Bank also helps bring down the upfront cost of solar systems so people can invest in themselves.
We are an administrator of an incentive program to deploy 350 megawatts of residential solar, and we get paid back by the creation of renewable energy credits that come from those solar PV systems that we sell to the electric distribution companies who are required to comply to a renewable portfolio standard, enabling us to recover the cost for providing those incentives up front. This has helped over 40,000 families reduce the burden of energy costs because we know that over the useful life of a solar PV system, that the energy savings that are coming are greater than what your financing costs are. So you are immediately in the black. You're immediately putting money back into your family.
As the nation's first green bank, there's been some learning. At first, 95% of their loans ended up going to upper and middle income neighborhoods.
When we took a look at that data, we asked ourselves, okay, we're seeing solar PV being deployed. That's good. But we're leaving a whole segment of our society behind. In Connecticut, low to moderate income families can spend anywhere between 10, 15 to 20% of their household income on energy.
They tripled the financial incentives for low to moderate income families, got banks to lend to borrowers with lower credit scores, and added a solar leasing program, which applies that higher financial incentive to offer a lower cost lease. And they invested in outreach.
This isn't a TV and air wars sort of a marketing campaign. You have to be knocking on doors in communities. And then when one neighbor sees another doing it, they ask, you know, tell me about it. And you see blocks, literally blocks, starting to do solar PV. So through this program, we actually completely eliminate that energy burden.
Now the trend on who gets solar has been reversed, with the highest rates of deployment in communities of color.
Connecticut is a solar with justice state.
The Green Bank is also working on geographic equity.
There are a number of cities and towns that have been left behind in terms of the clean energy economy. So we've developed this program to specifically reach out to them and say, okay, tell us more about your town's buildings. Okay, you've got a fire station, a police station, a library, a school building. You've got a town hall. What do your energy costs look like? And then what we do is we remotely assess the potential of those buildings to site solar photovoltaic systems. And we say, okay, town X, we see an opportunity here for a parking structure, solar PVs, solar PV systems for the town hall, for your multifamily affordable housing authorities. We run a competitive solicitation for those towns so that we could find the best contractor to do the work. And then the Green Bank provides the capital to help finance those projects through something called a power purchase agreement. So literally, those towns would be paying about 8 to 10 cents per kilowatt hour for solar PV being produced on their rooftops, while displacing what they're paying the utility, which is anywhere between 13 to 16 cents per kilowatt hour. So we're helping those towns reduce their energy costs on average about 20 to 25%.
In its first 10 years of existence, the Connecticut Green Bank has mobilized close to $2 billion, deployed 430 megawatts of clean electricity, and created over 20,000 jobs. Now they're looking to expand beyond energy.
Governor Lamont has proposed expanding the Green Bank's mandate beyond clean energy to include environmental infrastructure like waste and recycling systems, agriculture, land conservation, resiliency and adaptation. So applying this way of being smarter with public resources to decarbonize our environmental infrastructure.
Meanwhile, Connecticut's Green Bank is growing by mobilizing another source of money. You and me.
Green bonds are modeled after the war bonds of the 1940s. War bonds gave Americans the ability to support our fight in World War II. $185 billion was raised. That's the equivalent nearly of $3 trillion today. So when we're talking about national infrastructure and a $3 trillion price tag, Americans in the 1940s stepped up the equivalent of what we're looking at in terms of national infrastructure. $20 billion of that came from $25 bonds. We had that history to build on. Right now, our war is climate change. Bonds are typically sold in $5,000 levels. Institutional investors, your pension funds, your insurance companies, they are buying $5,000 units and buying millions of them. What we wanted to do is create a smaller denomination so that our families can actually purchase bonds. And if we can provide some mechanism that allows them to invest in confronting climate change, we felt they were going to take it.
That was before COVID hit. By the time the bonds went up for sale in July 2020, they were not so sure.
The bond markets had collapsed. The economy had collapsed. Clean energy deployment was slowing down. We were really worried.
They sold out in a single day, raising $17 million, mostly from small investors. They're doing it again this Earth Day, April 22nd. Find out more at greenlibertybonds.com. There's a bill in Congress to form a national green bank with $100 billion of public money, which is estimated to have the potential to leverage $800 billion in private investment. Brian has reservations about taking green banks national.
We have a federal government that has resources to support infrastructure, but everything's local. All our clean energy markets, all our infrastructure is approved, supported locally. The market context for clean energy investment in Connecticut is driven by the policies that are passed in Hartford, Connecticut. And then they're operationalized by regulatory mechanisms that happen in New Britain that determine how clean energy is being deployed. And then you think about the communities. This is really where the action happens.
Whether we stick with state banks or go national, our economist friend Bob Pollan says we'll get more for our money if we add some big sticks to our carrots, like renewable portfolio standards that require utilities to buy clean energy.
There's a lot of states that already have that, but the problem is they aren't enforced.
Bob wants to see some laws with real teeth.
Hit this target or you pay $50 million fine, or the CEO of the company goes to jail.
Hear, hear. I'm Wendy Ring, and you've been listening to Cool Solutions, climate action from the bottom up. Thanks to our guests, Robert Pollan, Clark Gilman, Anne Freeman Manzanares, Abe Solorio, and Brian Garcia, and to Broke for Free, Marissa Anderson and Scott Holmes for our music.